Whenever we have the pleasure of watching Michael Hanlon come to the podium, we know that the wisdom that follows will be provocative, obviously timely, and most of all will leave us with a wealth of food for thought. I anticipate that we will enjoy those riches again today. And now, while our news is overflowing a little bit with Putin, Russia, and Ukraine, we have obviously invited Mike, having done so 6 months ago, to broaden our understanding of the issues that we face in Asia, and particularly with China. How can the United States and China avoid an arms race? Strategic Reassurance and Resolve, Mike's new book, which will be coming out shortly, speaks to those very challenges as we manage a relationship that has its hostile moments and yet also has an opportunity, as Mike says, for interdependence. Mike O'Hanlon is a senior fellow with the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and is director of research for the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, where he specializes in U.S. defense strategy, the use of military force, and American foreign policy. He is also often invited to be one of the many very brilliant talking heads that we see on Sunday mornings. And if you see him during the week, there's a little sartorial note that I wanted to add, and that is, if you see a blue and black striped tie, which I happen to know hangs on the back of his closet door at his office, it means that he's been called at zero hour. He grabs the only tie he's got. And I think you just put a tick in the box for the number of times that you see that. And maybe the next time Mike comes, we're going to get him a tie with an alligator, because I think that would be appropriate. And it shows his support for the Naples Council on World Affairs. Mike got his AB, his MSE, and his PhD from that great school, Princeton University. And he is obviously a great devotee and goes down there often to speak as well. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael O'Hanlon.
As you're an amazing organization here, Mimi is an amazing person. A couple of things I should say. First of all, about 2 hours ago when I was speaking with her around lunchtime, she said, "Oh, Mike, have you seen a copy of your book yet?" And I said, "Actually, no, I haven't." And she said, "Would you like to see it?" So she's literally so on top of things that she saw my book before I did. And on top of that, what a welcome. I mean, Naples is just the best place to visit in the United States, as far as I'm concerned, for so many reasons, but most of all because you have the most dynamic and energized and well-informed World Affairs Council that I've ever seen. And I've had the pleasure of speaking in a number of places, so thanks to you. I also want to say the last time I traveled for a conference or a talk, it was 2 weeks ago to go to Ottawa, Canada. And it was actually a snow day there, believe it or not. And so it was a bad enough start. It was about 34 degrees, and they were, at least it wasn't icing like they had expected, and at least it wasn't snowing. But I was on this panel with four people. And we began the panel as the third period began of the U.S.-Canada men's hockey team, I kid you not. And so we all knew going into the panel that it was 1-0 Canada at that point. And I was, as I say, on this panel of four, I was the last to speak. So I got up there and I said, "Oh, it's wonderful to be in Canada. I grew up just over the border in New York State. I feel like almost an honorary Canadian. I went to Afghanistan for the first time with the Canadian military. I was designated as an honorary Canadian by the members of the trip that organized it. So I just want you to know that no matter who wins this hockey game, I'm claiming victory for myself." And I thought I had the last laugh. At which point, they, like almost everyone in the room, got up and said, "We just won! Yankee, go home!" And so I'm not even kidding. Every one of them, instead of listening to our panel, was following the hockey. Now, I couldn't blame them for that. So I think this might be a slightly more hospitable crowd, at least I'm hoping. And so what I'd like to do today is to talk to you about this book that Jim Steinberg and I have just finished, which is coming out, as Mimi kindly mentioned, in a month from Princeton Press. And it's called Strategic Reassurance and Resolve, Managing U.S.-China Security Relations. And let me just give you a quick word about the genesis of the book, because I think that'll give you a sense about where we are trying to go with the main argument. Jim Steinberg, as you probably know, was Deputy Secretary of State for the first 2.5 years of the Obama administration. He was Hillary's principal deputy. And one of the main things he did was to focus on East Asia, as this part of the world was, as you know, becoming more combustible, and with China's rise and other issues ongoing in that part of the world. And when Jim stepped down and took over the deanship at the Maxwell School at Syracuse, he asked me if I was thinking of working on China again. He said, you should write a book on how the U.S. and China manage their military competition in such a way that it doesn't get out of control. Because my experience, he said, is that there are a lot of potential aspects to this relationship that could lead it to spin out of control. He came away a little bit haunted by the prospect of a big hegemonic rivalry or competition emerging. And I said, Jim, that sounds great. I'll do it if you do it with me. And within about 30 seconds, we had agreed. And I think that for a guy who, like Hillary or any other person at that level in the State Department, had to think of about 200 different countries at a time, this was the issue that he left passionate about after his last tenure in government. I think it's fair to say more than any other. And the basic argument, and this is the way I'll sort of begin now to talk about the book, the basic argument that Jim made to me and that we begin the book with is that the U.S.-China relationship could go either way. And if you read certain scholars or certain points of view, they will sometimes say, nah, it's already pretty much predetermined. So there are pessimists out there, and John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago is one of them, a brilliant guy, and they'll say, anytime you got an established power and a rising power, that is trouble. And we sort of handled it okay at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, going from Britain to the United States, but that was sort of a friendly handoff. And on top of that, we actually didn't really handle it that well because it took two world wars before the United States was fully comfortable with this role of international leader. That's a pretty high price to pay to complete the transfer of power. Of course, along the way, Germany was thinking about taking on the mantra of the top European power, and we saw what happened partly as a result of that. So anytime you have this kind of a shift in power, you have trouble. And that's what, and there is a kernel of truth to that argument, certainly. And that's what some structural realists will sometimes argue. It's almost a deterministic view of the future, that you can almost predict it, and that we're in for trouble. Well, that's one point of view. And again, Jim and I have some sympathy with that argument, but it's too overdetermined. Then there's another school of thought that says, come on, all that talk is ancient history. Great powers used to behave that way, it's true. But look what they've learned. Look what they've been through. Individual human beings may not be any better or smarter than they were 150 years ago. But now we've been through two world wars and a long Cold War, and we have nuclear weapons pointed at each other, and we know better than to fight. So we're in a world also of great economic interdependence, where China and the United States mutually depend upon each other economically. And therefore, there's no real prospect of conflict. And that's sort of the, you know, you could say, be happy crowd, but it's also a serious way of thinking about the nature of the international system. And I have some sympathy with that argument, too, because I do think, and I know many of you were involved in this in your lives and in your careers and still are in many ways, that the kind of international system that was built up after World War II was built in such a way as to be pretty durable, pretty robust, and frankly, very good for China, as well as for us and our own interests. Look at what China's accomplished. China has carried out the greatest anti-poverty campaign in human history in the last four decades. China has brought more people out of squalor than any other country in human history since Mao. And it was the U.S.-led international system of economics, of trade, of investment, of military stability that permitted this. Even as we fought China head-to-head in Korea and then fought China indirectly to some extent in Vietnam, we still created an international system that right after all that difficult history was over, and then once Mao was out of the picture and Deng Xiaoping and others came in, China could then really take advantage. So you might say, why would China have any interest at all in overturning this system or in challenging this system, in engaging in an arms race with the protector of this system? Well, here's the reason for worry. Again, we're not deterministic. We don't say that any time you have an established power and a rising power that the two must butt heads, nor do we say that because we have nuclear deterrence and economic interdependence, we must get along. What we say, rather, is it's all going to depend. It's going to depend on decisions the two countries make and, of course, their allies. Because just when we think we're in a stable period in U.S.-China relations, Taiwan or Japan or somebody else or the Philippines throws in a little bit of a hand grenade and life gets more complicated. So Jim is really he's not a China scholar per se, but he's really spent a great deal of time thinking about that country's evolution. And he felt powerfully that we should begin the argument by saying, look at China's history. If you look over the last 1,000 years, let's start around the year 1000. Around the year 1000, China is the superpower. Now, they didn't really nobody had the ability to operate at a global distance in that period of time, but China had a great deal of influence around its neighborhood. As we all know, when we see the resemblance of the Japanese language, Japanese art and culture to China, for example. And China was way ahead of Europe in technology, in paper, gunpowder. China was arguably even further ahead of Europe than that in behaving decently. This is when the Europeans were in the medieval period of warfare at a local level, and then they got ready for a big period of warfare at a global level. And China, sure, had its wars and its conquests, but the Chinese societies of those days in the Middle Ages were probably more peaceful and, frankly, more civilized than much of Europe was at the time. And then we got to the period China went out and sort of sowed its wild oats. An admiral named Zheng He and a few others had big ocean-faring ships, and they spread the Chinese culture. In the Chinese mind, this was all very benign, sharing the great civilization that really blossomed in China with the less advanced, less civilized peoples that China could reach. So there was an arrogance or a high confidence associated with this. But in the Chinese mind, there was also a restraint. There was no colonization per se. There was not a lot of aggression. There weren't big wars of conquest. And after Zheng He did this for a while, the Chinese just decided, you know what? This was around 1500, a little before. We've had enough of this. Let's burn our fleet. Let's bring back our populations from their coastal regions into the interior. And let's sort of shut ourselves off from the world. And then the Chinese went through a period of self-imposed isolation. And to some extent, this was probably born of arrogance, that they felt they had earned the mantra of the Middle Kingdom. They were God's chosen people. The world essentially revolved around China. And they didn't need to go out and proselytize or teach. They could just continue to run their great operation. And, you know, it was a reasonable point of view in some ways because they really were that sophisticated. Meanwhile, Europe is learning how, as Jared Diamond and others have taught us, Germany was learning how to bend steel, build big ships, create gunpowder, create cannons. And Europe went into the period of great military conquest, competition, colonialism, imperialism, roughly from the 1400s, you know, for a few centuries thereafter, and colonized a lot of Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, and then finally worked its way around to East Asia. And then starting in 1839, the Europeans, with a little bit of help occasionally from us, imposed ourselves on China. And we demanded certain access to their markets. We created the open door policy. We essentially coerced them into doing a certain amount of trade with the outside world, even when they didn't want to. And that was bad enough. But then, of course, this period was culminated in the Japanese invasion, occupation, the barbarities, the atrocities that only ended with the end of World War II. So the Chinese went through a century of humiliation, roughly 1839 to 1945. And that is branded in their brains as something they must never allow to be repeated. So the Middle Kingdom sort of, you know, chastised in terms of its own role in the world by this horrible historical experience, and angered by the century of humiliation, decides it's got to be better at protecting its own core interests. Now, for the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, they didn't really have the capacity to do so. Now they do. So that's the sort of immovable object. Chinese nationalism, patriotism, a desire not to repeat this period, and now a military capability to back it up. Meanwhile, the United States, and Jim and I are two Americans writing the book, and we love our country. And when I don't wear my blue and black striped tie, I often wear my blue tie with my little American flags. So we weren't pretending there's anything wrong with the United States or that we could really write this book as a critic of the United States or as two critics. But we did try to do a little bit of amateur psychology on the United States. And this is not purely our own fabrication. It comes out of a lot of American literature and a lot of American history. And my colleague Robert Kagan and others have done writing on the subject as well. And basically, we challenge the story that we Americans love to tell ourselves about our preference to be left alone and let the outside world just do its own thing, and we'll do our thing. We've got a wonderful North American paradise, and who could debate that today in Naples, Florida? All we want to do is be left alone. Wouldn't these Europeans and these Asians and these others stop fighting each other long enough that we can all just get along, and so we Americans can exploit and develop and enjoy this wonderful North American utopia and not have to be bothered by all these troublesome other powers? Sometimes we tell ourselves that story as Americans, and Jim and I, again building on Bob Kagan's argument, basically say, no. History does not support that interpretation of American behavior or strategic culture. We spent the 19th century expanding our borders and taking every bit of land on the North American continent we could get our hands on. And then once we were done with that, we had a temporary period of colonialism ourselves. And by the way, this is not a criticism of the United States, because then the key formative period was World War II and the Cold War. And we decided in those two experiences that American power is essential to global stability. We had tried to stay partially disengaged from World War I, from the coming of World War II, and we saw that we really could not be successful with that approach, so we changed, and we developed an American strategic culture of peace through strength, as Ronald Reagan would put it, American exceptionalism, American leadership, to use a more benign term. But the basic point is always the same. We have to stay stronger than anyone else, and we have to stay forward deployed, forward engaged, and proactive in the problems around the world, because if we let others handle their own problems, they won't do so very well, and we'll be dragged in eventually, whether we like it or not. And that attitude is still alive and well, I would argue, even today. And it's mostly a good thing, I would argue. Jim and I argue in the book. American leadership really is important. But we have to have a little perspective on ourselves. We have this strategic culture that basically says, if in doubt, more American assertiveness, more American engagement is better than less. And there is still a lot of debate in the United States. You know, now Obama's weak because he's not somehow preventing Crimea from being poached by Putin. You know, and we still see them, and you can like Obama or not, but it's interesting how we come back to this issue. Because Obama has only maintained a $600 billion defense budget, only fought two wars, only killed one Osama bin Laden, rebalanced to Asia, he's not strong enough. And the issue is, because he's made a couple of mistakes or been a little feeble here or there, like in Syria, therefore the whole world is doubting American strength. I'm not trying to trivialize the debate. It's an important debate, and I share the criticisms of President Obama's Syria policy. But I would ask that you take a step back and maybe try to think about what it says about us as Americans, that we somehow assume that what's happening in Crimea might be partly due to our own policy, or that it might be primarily up to us to fix it. And this reflects America's proactive approach towards the world, which was forged in the experiences of World War II and the Cold War, and which remains very powerful, even as we like to tell ourselves that politically we're getting isolationist, and we're pulling back home, and we're tired of foreign policy. Nonsense. And even if we feel that way today, within a year or two, I bet we won't. And if it's Marco Rubio against Hillary Clinton or some two other candidates like that in 2016, there aren't going to be too many hints of American retreatism in the presidential race either. So we have the very strong American view of American assertiveness, the fixed object of Chinese resolve and growing strength, and this, combined with our allies, provides a very combustible mix. And we're seeing it now with the Senkaku Islands, with the Scarborough Shoal, with many other issues and aspects to the U.S.-China relationship. And Jim and I say it is a problem, because it's not just a theoretical disagreement. There are specific things that China now wants to do differently. I'm not sure China can specify its goals, but it wants more influence and control in the waters to its east, and it wants to be the first among equals in the Western Pacific. And it doesn't necessarily know what that means. It doesn't necessarily know how to attain that. It doesn't necessarily know when it will be satisfied with whatever accomplishments it may make in that direction. But there is a visceral sense. I was in Mao's birthplace last fall at a military academy, and I heard this from several of the speakers. And it really struck me, a very powerful chord, that the Chinese, they can't exactly put their finger on what they want, but they know they want it. And they're not going to repeat this century of humiliation. And by the way, if they could take a couple of elbows at the Japanese expense along the way, all the better. But that's probably almost a secondary goal in some ways to just making sure that they are at least the regional dominant power. But the United States still wants to operate reconnaissance flights 12 miles off the Chinese coast. We still want to defend Japanese claims to 5 uninhabited rocks. We don't even really care who owns them. We don't even recognize that the Japanese have sovereignty over them. But we agree that since the Japanese are administering them, and we are Japan's ally, that we will apply the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty to those 5 rocks. That's the kind of mix we've got in the region right now. And by the way, Jim and I do not say pull back. This is not an argument for American retrenchment. And we also go through the book and talk about America's enduring strengths. And if you want to discuss America's so-called decline in the question and answer period, I would love to. I personally do not subscribe to American decline. I don't think it's likely. I don't think it's happening now. When I look around at our assets and our allies and our advantages, I'm still struck by this country being the most powerful on the planet, the most powerful probably that it's ever been, despite our problems, despite our challenges. So this argument is not born of American defeatism, but it's still basically saying you take these two countries and this Chinese vision for more influence, and then you combine that with what's happening with technology. So now, we've been used to sailing our aircraft carriers around the Western Pacific for decades and treating the Western Pacific like an American lake. We can go anywhere in the Western Pacific we want, ever since the end of World War II, more or less with impunity. In the Cold War, the Soviets could have tried to go after a carrier if they had wanted to with an attack submarine, but we might have heard them coming. In any event, that was now 20-some years ago. We've operated like this is an American lake. But now the Chinese have satellites that can begin to track our aircraft carriers. They have anti-ship ballistic missiles, which can be launched and within maybe 10 minutes be in the general vicinity of an aircraft carrier. And then it can deploy a homing munition, which can then zero in on the carrier. So we are at a point now where military technology may make our carrier force vulnerable. It certainly is making our assets in places like Okinawa, Japan, more vulnerable to Chinese attack than they've been before. So the military balance is changing fast. And a lot of it we're handling very well ourselves. We still have an overwhelming advantage in military capability vis-a-vis the Chinese. We still spend 600 and some billion a year, although that's coming down closer to 500 billion. And the Chinese, by the way, are pushing 200 billion. And their budget is doubling every 10 years. Now, if their economic growth slows, it may take them 12 years, 15 years to double it again. But by the 2020s, we're going to be looking at some rough equality in terms of spending levels if things stay on their current track. Now, we have incredible advantages because we've been spending a lot of money on defense for a long time. So we have all this accumulated high technology. And in the book, Jim and I estimate the U.S. has about $3 trillion in modern weaponry, defined as fourth-generation aircraft essentially built in the 1980s and going forward, and other technology, ships, tanks, etc. We have about $3 trillion worth of high-tech stuff. The Chinese only have a couple hundred billion. So it's about a 15-to-1 ratio. But that's going to close. Now, we have other advantages. We have the most powerful alliance system in the history of the planet. And our allies spend, again, almost as much as we do. But, of course, our allies can also be a challenge for us because we're sworn to protect them and because they don't always spend their defense dollars very efficiently. So when you put this basic picture together, it's a pretty interesting mix of where this could be headed. By the way, just one quick additional point on the military spending. Did you know that 10 years ago, when Donald Rumsfeld, who of course was Secretary of Defense at the time, went to a conference in Singapore, and he complained to the Chinese about their defense budget. And he said, what are you spending all this money on defense for? You don't have any enemies. You don't have any problems. People wonder. People are asking questions. Why are the Chinese spending almost $100 billion a year on their military? Well, they didn't really answer his question, but now it's 2014, and they're spending almost $200 billion a year on their military. And by the way, you know who's number three? Russia, at about $75 to $80 billion. And now we have the other American allies, well, American allies like Britain, Germany, Japan, France, somewhere around $50 billion each. So we still have a lot of really good allies, but the world military spending pecking order has shifted a lot in the last 10 years, with the United States still obviously number one, but China very clearly number two, and now Putin and Russia number three. And in the 90s, it wasn't like that. In the 90s, it was the U.S., and then Britain, France, Germany, Japan, and then maybe Russia on a good day, but probably South Korea or Israel or Saudi Arabia or maybe India, and so on. So things are shifting. Okay, so that's the basic situation that Jim and I try to lay out. Now let me spend a few minutes talking about some of our ideas for what to do about this, because unfortunately the diagnosis is easier than the solution, because the obvious solutions don't work. Obvious solution number one would be, wouldn't it be great if the Chinese would just accept that this international system that we helped create and that we still essentially police works for them incredibly well. It's made them so rich and has allowed them to bring all these people out of poverty. And the Chinese say, yeah, you know, system's pretty good, but there are a few things about it we'd like to change. For example, we'd like to be the number one power in the Western Pacific, in case you forgot that part of our history. We don't want any more century of humiliation. We are the Middle Kingdom. You may be the shining city on the hill, but we're the Middle Kingdom. And if there's anybody around the planet besides the French who can match American self-confidence, it's the Chinese. And so they are prepared to say, you know, you go ahead with your national narrative. We've got ours. Thank you very much for this trading system. By the way, I think it's pretty good for you too, because you buy a lot of our stuff. So don't give us too many lectures about how you are doing this as a favor to us. But, yeah, we want to keep most of it, but we would like some things to shift along the way. So obvious solution, Chinese acquiescence in the way things used to be. That ain't going to work. Solution number two, we just try to outcompete them. We do another Reagan military buildup. And to some extent, Governor Romney was proposing that in 2012. He didn't talk that much about the China aspect, but he actually did favor a much more robust military spending path than President Obama. Just so you know, my politics on defense spending, I'm probably somewhere between the two, probably a little closer to Obama, but you can have a good debate about U.S. defense spending levels. But the problem is, our GDP is about $16 trillion. The Chinese GDP, depending on how you measure it, is somewhere around half of that, maybe a little more. And they're growing 8 to 10% a year, and we're growing 3% a year. So, yeah, that could change. They could slow down to 7%. We could go up to 3.1%. But it's not going to change that much. And the Chinese do have huge issues, as you know, with their demographics after the one-child policy for so many years, with their water and air pollution, with constraints on their energy resources. Certainly, if you wanted to compare the natural endowment of China and the United States, you should prefer our natural endowment. And not just because we have Naples, Florida, although that's a big part of it, but we have a wonderful mix of water and energy, and you can see that in our energy revolution again today. And most of our land is reasonably arable. You know, we've got a lot of advantages. The Chinese have a lot of problems, but there are people who have had a lot of problems for a long time, and they've been growing 8 to 10% a year. And I bet you they'll still grow 6, 7, 8% a year. So the idea of just committing ourselves to an arms race that we will win, the way that Reagan showed down or faced down the Soviets, doesn't look quite as promising in this case. I'm not arguing against a good debate about what our defense spending should be, but if you put it on a 10 to 20 year perspective, it's hard to believe that is a simple solution. And Jim and I also do not favor abandoning any American allies or even Taiwan. There are some people who say, like Charles Glazer at George Washington University, we probably should just acknowledge that Taiwan is not a an entity that we really want to be in the business of protecting over the long term. China cares too much about it. It's too close to China for really American military power to defend very easily. Let's try to get out of the business of defending defending Taiwan any more than we're going to defend Crimea through military force. And it's a serious argument. But Jim and I actually don't make that argument in the book, partly because deterrence of China is working pretty well in regard to Taiwan, and we don't want to throw away a system that's working. We'd like to evolve it in a slightly different direction. So let me now work through just a few of the categories of ideas, and I'll do this quickly, and then we can have a discussion about what you think, because the basic idea in the book is that we need a concept like strategic reassurance, because there's not going to be any simple silver bullet solution. We're not going to be able to just say, if we change this policy or if they change that policy, the whole problem goes away. No, this problem's going to be with you and me and my kids and your kids and all of our grandkids. This is going to be probably the chief hegemonic issue, if I can use that word, of the 21st century. And we're going to have to embark on a policy that combines resoluteness and resolve with reassurance. Now, if you read some of the transcripts of President Obama's early thinking on China, he talked about how we would like to have strategic trust with the Chinese. And Jim and I, in our book, we say, that's a nice goal, but it ain't going to happen anytime soon. Trust is too high of an expectation. You're not going to create trust. What you have to do is engage in a process where you look for ways to stand by your allies and stand by your interests, but take a little bit of an edge off the more dangerous aspects of the military competition if you can. That's the philosophy of the book. So now let me give you a few suggestions. We have about 20 of them in the book, and we don't say this is the be-all and end-all list. Some of them will not be adopted, I'm sure. Some of them are probably incomplete, and they're going to need to be changed, edited, added to as the years go by. But this is the best we could do in a 2014 argument. So let me begin with some arms control ideas. A lot of these ideas are not arms control. A lot of them are about unilateral restraint, unilateral gestures of some restraint, followed by reciprocity, we hope, by the other side. But some of them could be arms control. And I'll mention a couple. Some of them are very modest. For example, both sides, as you know, operate a lot of satellites. And both sides have shot down one of their satellites when they malfunctioned in recent years. And there's this worry that maybe we're going to get into a space race where we both start developing anti-satellite weapons to shoot down the other's satellites in a war, because these satellites have become so important in military targeting that you can't really afford to have your enemy use their satellite. So if you cannot jam the satellite with electronic noise, you better shoot it down. That's one line of military thinking. And Jim and I, we're not naive. We know it's going to be pretty hard to prevent that entirely. For one thing, whenever we build an anti-missile defense, a ballistic missile defense system, that system has a certain amount of anti-satellite capability inherent within it, whether you admit it or not, whether you try to put it there or not. So we say, let's just ban peacetime activities that create so much debris in space that they are harmful to the interests of both sides and other spacefaring nations. So any kind of a collision or an explosion above roughly 500 to 1,000 kilometers altitude, we say should be banned. And the U.S. and China could lead an international effort to create that kind of a treaty, and they could begin by agreeing to a protocol themselves as a bilateral accord. You can still do testing below that level, because when you test below that level, a ballistic missile defense system, for example, if you create debris by a collision or an explosion, the debris will fall back to Earth and be burned up by the atmosphere. It's when you do it a little higher that it stays there and could damage satellites. So that's one small idea. Another small idea. How many of you, I won't ask for a show of hands, I'll say it rhetorically, but how many of you realize the Open Skies Treaty is actually still in effect? Remember that concept? It goes back to Eisenhower. He wanted the two countries to be able to, the U.S. and Soviet Union, to be able to look at each other's territory with aerial reconnaissance flights. And then at the end of the Cold War, we actually negotiated this among a lot of the former Warsaw Pact and NATO countries. And we still do about 100 flights a year to inspect each other's territories across all those 30-some countries that are participating. And Russia flies over the U.S., and we fly over Russia. And it's all done very politely. You have to file your flight profile in advance so the other country knows where you're trying to spy, and they can take certain measures. So it may not be the best reconnaissance, but here's the thing about it. Here's why Jim and I like the idea for the U.S. and China. Right now, the Chinese are getting increasingly angry, as we saw in the EP3 episode in 2001, when the Chinese pilot forced down, or the P3 aircraft. Actually, one Chinese pilot died along the way. And that plane was on Hainan Island for a number of weeks before its release was negotiated by President Bush. The Chinese continue to harass and try to interfere with our ships and airplanes operating near their coast. And their basic idea is no. Remember what we said, no more century of humiliation. No more big outside powers getting right up in our face and using military assets right against our territory. But the American reply is, hey, we're just looking. This is just reconnaissance. And we got to know what you're up to. So there's no meeting of the minds. And what Jim and I say is, the United States probably still has to do a lot of this reconnaissance. But if we negotiate an open skies accord with the Chinese, we can let them fly over our country just like we fly over theirs. That's not going to be the sum total of all of our reconnaissance of each other. Heaven knows the Chinese are stealing most of our secrets and spying on us in other ways, electronically mostly. And so this is going to be as much symbolic as anything. But it creates a certain amount of reciprocity and symmetry, and we think it may take an edge off the Chinese frustration with what we do and what we need to keep doing in that part of the world. So there are a few more ideas like this on arms control or, agreements of various sorts. Just one more to mention briefly. With the Soviets, we used to have an incidence at sea agreement. So, for example, if the other side was doing aircraft carrier flight practice and exercises, you didn't get in the way of where the airplanes were coming down. You didn't position your ship in a place where it could be hazardous to the other side's exercise. And there were a few other things. Submarines should announce where they are. If they're operating near an exercise of the other country, they should announce where they are before they surface, things like that. Safety-oriented activities and notification schemes. We don't have that right now with the Chinese, and I think we should. Now, with the Chinese, you probably got to bring in their Coast Guard, their maritime surveillance, their fisheries protection agencies. And the Chinese are pretty good at using their other agencies of the government for espionage and military purposes. So you've got to be a little bit more inclusive. But I think we should try to negotiate that. Okay, so that's one set of ideas, and it's arms control and confidence building. Another set of ideas has to do with military modernization. And then I'm going to mention a little bit about this, and then I'll wrap up on Korea, where I think we actually have an opportunity to come up with some creative ideas for how to take an edge off the competition there, too. Okay, on military modernization, I mentioned to you already that we spend still about $600 billion a year on our military. The Chinese are now spending about $200 billion a year on theirs, and this gap is closing because we're going down and they're coming up. And the Chinese may or may not like this argument. I tried it out. I went to Beijing when I was doing the book research, and I gave this talk at Beijing University, and The academics didn't really mind it too much. I'm not sure how many of the military guys are going to love this idea. But we suggest to the Chinese that as your defense spending approaches the halfway mark of American military spending, that you think about slowing down. And we don't suggest they stop. And we don't suggest that you could put this into a treaty, because I'm sure some of you remember the debate about the Washington Naval Treaty just before World War II, and we tried to lock in a certain relative balance of power, and it proved hard to monitor, and technology was changing anyway, and so it was ultimately a not very successful treaty. If you try to measure military spending on the two sides, you're beginning with two different currencies. A lot of the Chinese costs are not really purely convertible to a market economy. Some of them are, some are not. And so you can't really put that into an arms control treaty. Plus, I'm pretty sure the Chinese would not accept permanent 2-to-1 inferiority in military spending vis-a-vis the United States. But Jim and I just say, maybe you should slow down. And here's the reason why. Because the United States is still protecting much of the Persian Gulf, including oil supplies that fuel the Chinese economy. In fact, ironically, we're protecting more Chinese oil coming from the Persian Gulf than we are protecting oil headed for our own country. So we're protecting the oil that drives China, Japan, India, Europe. And very little of that oil comes to our shores. But as you know, oil is a global commodity. The price is set by the global market. And so we still have an interest in the safe and free flow of oil. And that's why we've always got 1 to 2 aircraft carriers around Iran, and a lot of other military capability in the region as well. So Jim and I say to the Chinese, maybe you should think about acknowledging that you only have to worry about the Western Pacific, and we have to worry about the Western Pacific plus the broader Middle East. Now, again, I'm sure a lot of you have thought about the potential downsides to trying this argument on the Chinese. Some of them might say, well, actually, we don't really like you having your hands around our economic throat in the Persian Gulf, so our next goal is to actually change that. And we'd rather come and help you with the security of the Persian Gulf rather than concede that for some reason you get to protect it forever, and keep your hand around our neck such that you could cut off our oil supply anytime you chose. So that would be the natural Chinese counter-response. And we acknowledge we're going to hear some of that from Chinese. And so we don't propose this could be a permanent solution. But in the short term, we are protecting China's oil. And they're doing very well, thank you, as a result, economically. And so they might want to, at least as a gesture of good faith, and also in the interest of using their scarce natural resources for other things they need to do internally to improve their water supply and a few other things about their population's well-being, they might want to think about slowing the rate of military spending a little bit at that point. We would also love to see the Chinese have enough confidence about the future of Taiwan that they no longer need to try to deter a Taiwan move towards independence with a military threat. And we suggest there may be an opportunity here for the United States to talk more to China about a policy that we've essentially had for a long time, which is that if Taiwan ever did declare independence out of the blue, without any previous effort to explain it, to develop it, to work together with China on this, that we would not recognize it. And this may sound tough and cold towards our Taiwanese friends, but in fact, the Taiwan population and political system has the potential to create World War III. Based on an overly ambitious pursuit of independence. And I'm not sure we owe it to them to grant that right into perpetuity either. I think we have to take an interest in their security and try to help assure it. But if we could ever talk the Chinese out of the military threat, then it would be appropriate for us to say, if they ever do declare independence out of the blue, we're not going to recognize it, and we'll work with you to walk them back from that. And until they do, they will not benefit, and they may even suffer certain consequences. So we encourage that. So that's a long shot idea, but we encourage some consideration of that. One last idea on military modernization before I finish with Korea. The United States, as you know, has this incredibly robust defense budget and a very battle-hardened military. And we now have a concept called air-sea battle that the Air Force and the Navy developed about 4 years ago. And it's sort of the military complement to the rebalance towards the Asia-Pacific that President Obama and Secretary Clinton and Gates and others announced in the first term of Obama. And the idea is that even though there's no particular target country in mind, the spread of advanced military technologies is making it more difficult for the United States to operate close to other countries' shores. And therefore, we need to step up our integration of defensive systems and certain offensive systems in response. And that's called air-sea battle. And it was probably a good idea, and it has some virtue. But Jim and I say it actually has some problems as well, and the United States needs to start to think about fixing them. One problem begins with the name. Air-sea battle, for those of you who studied the Cold War and the U.S.-Soviet competition in Europe, evokes the memory of air-land battle. What was air-land battle? It was NATO's response to Soviet military modernization to try to prevent the Soviets from rapidly reinforcing their forces in Germany by interdicting them with these new things we were developing in the 1980s, precision-guided munitions and other kinds of weapons that were going to take out some of the Soviet military assets, transportation, and infrastructure links on the way to Europe. It was in the context of dealing with a Cold War rival. Now we're using the same framing, air-sea battle, same structure of the word, to essentially organize our military modernization in the Asia Pacific. And the official Pentagon position is it's not really directed at China, so China shouldn't worry. Well, if there's a single Chinese person out of 1.4 billion who believes that, I haven't found him yet. Because the Chinese are smart enough to say, listen, it happened to occur at about the same time as the rebalance, and every so often, people do talk about the China issue in the context of air-sea battle, and we have the biggest military budget besides you, and we're buying the technologies that you talk about defeating with air-sea battle. So come on, just do what you got to do, but don't treat us like idiots. We know it's about us. That's what the Chinese think. And they're probably three-fourths right. One-fourth wrong, three-fourths right. So Jim and I say, okay, some of the stuff that the Air Force and the Navy are doing is fine, but let's call it air-sea operations. Let's use a little broader term, a little friendlier term, a little less confrontational term, and also one that allows the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Army, to have a role, because air-sea battle has been created and dominated by the Navy and the Air Force. And they're trying to reach out to the other services, but it's sort of an afterthought. So they need to have a course correction anyway. And we also want to involve the U.S. Coast Guard and our U.S. allies, and maybe even to some extent the Chinese on certain missions within air-sea battle. So it's not air-sea battle, now it's air-sea operations. And Jim and I feel like normally words don't mean that much, but sometimes they mean a lot. And this is a good example of where changing the term itself could allow you to then explain in a broader sense what you're after with this concept. And one thing we suggest, a lot of the advocates of air-sea battle say we should build a lot of long-range strike systems. We should double the size of the bomber force. We should build intercontinental strike weapons, high-speed bombers, all sorts of things, because our bases are becoming vulnerable, and therefore we need to be able to strike the Chinese from further away and strike far into their homeland and early on in a war so as to take away their ballistic missiles, their submarines, etc. And there's a certain military logic to that, but it's also potentially very escalatory. And so what we say is, yes, the United States needs some of those kinds of assets, but we do not argue in favor of a much larger bomber force or a lot of these new kinds of long-range weaponry that are being proposed. If we have the capability to do certain things in a limited, finite way, fine, but we actually don't want to send the message that our primary intent in any future war with China is to immediately escalate to attacks against the Chinese homeland from faraway American bases. And some of air-sea battle thinking does push you in that direction. Not all of it, to be fair, but some of it. Okay, that's a pretty abstract argument unless you live in the world I live in the military planning environment inside Washington. So let me finish with one more concrete thing, and I'll do it quickly because I'm already up to about 40 minutes, I realize. But Korea. And here's the basic idea. I'll just put it on the table, and then we can have time to discuss. As you know, the United States is still committed to South Korea's defense in the event of another war on the Korean Peninsula. Well, we don't really have a role for China imagined or conceived in that kind of a hypothetical war. And it could be a war that North Korea begins by attacking South Korea. It could be a war that begins by an internal conflict inside of North Korea that produces civil conflict or state collapse. Or it could be one that we initiate if the North Koreans start using their nuclear reactor again to produce plutonium for weapons, and maybe we decide to bomb the reactor to prevent them from having that kind of capability. All those things are possible. Right now, we have no ability to coordinate with China on what would happen afterwards. And the Chinese are still North Korea's ally. So the American assumption is the Chinese wouldn't be stupid enough to fight this kind of a war twice. They already did it once. Didn't work out very well for anybody. They're not going to do it again. They know the North Koreans are crazy. They just can't get their arms around them and get them to shape up, but they at least know they're crazy. Well, they probably do know they're crazy, but I'm not so sure about the happy talk from that point on, because I think the Chinese, if there's another war in Korea, the Chinese may come south into at least the northern half of North Korea, whether we like it or not, for a number of reasons. First of all, they like having a buffer between an American ally and them. Secondly, they do feel like their credibility may be on the line about whether they are, you know, dependable. They don't have other allies, but they do have other interests. Third, they may want to try to help us secure the nuclear weapons that North Korea is believed to possess already, and that could be a good motive. Fourth, they will say they want to control refugee flows and take care of the North Korean displaced on their own territory rather than have them flow into China. So that will be their premise or their pretext. But they also will want bargaining leverage once the war is over. And this is my theory. It's in the book. It's our speculation. We think there's a good chance it's true. What they will say is, okay, the war's over. Kim Jong-un is gone, dead or arrested or whatever. And we've got forces in northern North Korea, and the Americans have forces throughout the rest of the peninsula. That's all fine. We will be happy to pull our forces back home as soon as the Americans leave too. And I think the Chinese would very much like to have that kind of leverage in a post-North Korea negotiation, because they don't really want an American ally on their doorstep. So what Jim and I suggest is the following. Let's anticipate that, and let's work with it. First of all, we could actually use Chinese military help in northern North Korea if this scenario ever unfolds. By the way, I don't think the scenario is going to happen. But just talking about it, planning it with the Chinese could be helpful. And they may not want to do it at the official level because they realize the North Koreans get angry when the premise for this conversation is the future dismemberment of the North Korean state. So they tend not to want to provoke Kim Jong-un any more than they have to. But we can have this conversation either more quietly or with retired Chinese officials, track two dialogues, that sort of thing. And then Jim and I say, once the war is over, we don't have to stress out, we Americans, because whatever decision the South Koreans make at that point is going to be fine by us. If they really want us to leave, we can leave. They probably won't want us to leave. They'll probably want us to stay, and they'll want the Chinese to leave. They'll want us as ballast against the Chinese. And Jim and I argue that in that situation, the Chinese are going to have a very hard time staying, or at least not with more than a very small force in the northern part of North Korea. Maybe a tiny rump state at worst. So in other words, this is an opportunity to build U.S.-China trust today, or at least I shouldn't say trust. It's an opportunity to build some degree of U.S.-China collaboration. If the war happens, we get their help, and after the war, we still probably get the outcome we most want. So from an American point of view, it's basically win-win-win. Hopefully the Chinese will see it as partially advantageous as well, because that's the kind of idea we're trying to develop in the book. So let me stop there. I apologize I've gone on at such length. I appreciate very much your patience in indulging the long presentation. I look forward to your thoughts. Thank you.
I'll try to make this a very brief question, but I come to mind with the phrases we had in the past of mutually assured destruction or the thermonuclear suicide club. And very little is said about the human error. In other words, no system is foolproof. And so when we talk about, you know, this rather humongous escalation, are we making things too dangerous, or is it worth taking the risk, or do we blow up somebody? I don't know. I'm really very concerned about that.
I think you're right to be concerned. Unfortunately, we live in that world already. It's not necessarily a world that's going to arise because of Chinese military growth or strength. As you know, we've had that with the Soviet Union for a long time. I do, in general, favor avoiding nuclear threats. And by the way, I don't have this confidence that some people do, that because we have nuclear weapons on both sides, that guarantees peace. Because the problem is, of course, countries can persuade themselves, well, no one's going to use nuclear weapons over the Senkaku Islands. So you're sort of allowed to keep these small little wars under the nuclear threshold in the mind of some people. The problem is, at what point does that now start to seem to be a broader threat to either country's territory? And if we escalate and we attack submarine bases on the Chinese homeland, and then we accidentally hit a nuclear-armed submarine in the process of doing that, and we're just trying to do this to protect the Japanese Navy so the Chinese subs can't attack the Japanese Navy, you can see how these things escalate. Maybe that's along the lines of what you're referring to in your own concerns as well. I share that, which is why I'd like to get through this period of reassurance to the point where we actually can stop worrying about these mutual interactions. I mean, I wish the Chinese would just not push it over issues like the Senkakus, and I actually wish that the Japanese would have some creative diplomatic approaches. For example, they might say to the Chinese, these are our islands, but if you want to claim sovereignty too, we'll administer them. You can send, you know, wildlife expeditions and so forth and nature clubs, and we'll create a new concept of sovereignty that's essentially both countries claiming it, and we don't mind you doing that as long as you acknowledge that we're still going to administer it. I would welcome it if the Japanese would say that. Unfortunately, the Japanese have not yet said that. So as long as these two countries want to fight over these five meaningless pieces of rock, one thing I know for sure, I don't want my daughters fighting in defense, even of Japan, over those rocks. If there are any Japanese friends here, I apologize, but that's the way I feel. And I don't think most Americans are necessarily going to disagree. So we have to avoid a situation where some of these meaningless squabbles can blow up. And so I'm with you on the spirit of your question. There's just no easy way to guarantee that this thing is going to go in a happy direction. And that's why we wrote the book. We don't think peace is predetermined. If there were one simple thing anybody could do to solve it, we could just advocate for that. But I think you're seeing a rising China that's feeling its oats, that's still angry at Japan, that wants to be first among equals in the Western Pacific, and they're trying to feel their way towards what that means. We're going to have to guide them as they do that in a way that moves them towards an acceptable version of how they can have greater influence in the Western Pacific, but not displace us and not bully our allies. That's going to take a lot of effort. Thanks.